I'm Andrew Murata, host of the Education, Leadership, and Beyond podcast, a part of the Education Podcast Network, just like the show you are listening to now. Shows on the network are individually owned and opinions expressed may not reflect others. Find other interesting education podcasts at edupodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the EduGals podcast. We are your co-hosts, Rachel Johnson
and Katie Atwell. We are here to bring you tips and tricks to help you integrate technology into your classroom.
In this episode, we are talking about why you might not want to use the 100 points grading scale and what you might want to do instead.
Yes, so we will explain some of the reasons why the 100-point scale is not such a great scale to use and how you can flip that around and make grading more equitable.
Let's get started. This week, Katie and I are going to be chatting a bit about grades. And so we're going to get into why there's an issue with using the 100-point scale, as well as what we could do instead.
Yeah. So when we look at the way we've been grading, and we've been on a bit of a journey with ungrading, we've done a lot of learning over time. And there's some really great resources out there that kind of have helped guide us. And it's worth having that conversation because failures and zeros and all of these have huge impact on our students' success and don't actually reflect their learning.
And I would say, just before we jump into this conversation, I think probably one of the best resources that I've come across that talks about different grading practices that are essentially bias resistant and equitable for students is Grading for Equity by Joe Feldman. It's such an excellent book and really just gets into all of the different sort of issues around grades and grading.
Yeah, no, and that's the one that I did a lot of referring to this week as well as we were kind of preparing for this episode. But he really explains things well and in a way that it's easy to understand and it makes a lot of sense. And so if you're wondering where to start with some of this learning, his resource is definitely great.
So why don't we start with talking about the 100-point scale and what's wrong with the 100-point scale? Because this scale, giving a student a percentage grade from 0 to 100 is something that is inherent in all of our education systems.
Yes, it's everywhere. And it's hard to escape. And we can't really escape it necessarily because we're still having to create a mark out of 100, but there are workarounds and things that we can do to help it more accurately reflect student learning.
So I think one of the, I would say probably the biggest problem with a 100-point scale is that it's biased towards failure.
Yeah, 49 to 50%. You have of that 100-point scale, we're really saying, you guys got this failure. Let's go. Buckle it down.
Well, and if any of our listeners are in the States, passing grade is 60% or greater. Oh, so there's 60 points in this 100-point scale that are dedicated to failure and only 40 points that are dedicated towards passing. In Ontario, slightly better, right? 50 points dedicated to passing, 50 points dedicated to failure. But still, half of it, at least half of it, is dedicated towards failure.
Yeah, and it does make you think, why do we have so much of a breakdown for failure criteria instead of, you know, boosting what passing can look like?
And so if you then think about, well, if you give a student a zero,
yeah,
think about how challenging that is for that student to then overcome that grade to be able to recover from that. It basically disproportionately punishes students.
And I mean, like, I know why we do it around reporting times for students that having completed work, just as like you need to complete something, so I have something to mark on and to grade you. But all of the zeros aren't necessary. We should be looking at overall learning and not every single step of the process.
Yeah, and one other thing that really kind of goes against this 100-point scale. So the reason why a 100-point scale is not great is because you have too many transition points between grades for you to be able to make any sort of good judgment on student work. So for example, you can't, like, judging between an 88 and an 87, Like, really, what is that, right? There are so many, there are 101, I guess, transition points between grades that you have to judge student work. And so that then becomes really tricky in defining criteria for, well, what is an 88 versus an 87? That's really, really hard to do.
Yeah. And if you were to show me an assignment that I marked as an 87 versus an 88, I would have no idea why they were different. I'm going to be honest, because like it is really hard to distinguish.
And then that becomes a big issue. You know, if you take a piece of work and you have, say, your department team or your course team all grade this one piece of student work on a 100-point scale, that's where you get all the different discrepancies between grades. Like, some people might give it a 90 versus some people might give it an 80 or 70. And you get this sort of wide range of grades, which then becomes that issue of consistency, right, between different teachers evaluating the same piece of work.
Now, one thing I think that has helped with that is the use of levels. Because here in Ontario, we use levels 1 through 4, where they're all passes, but there's a 1-1 and a 1+. So there is that range within, and then it's not getting that nitpicky between like an 87 and an 88. It is more kind of, I don't know if you want to say averaged, but it's a bigger ballpark in terms of the mark.
And that is one of the recommendations that we would have in terms of moving away from a 100-point scale and moving away from this bias and this discrepancy between assigning different grades, is using a scale that has fewer points. In Ontario, like you said, we have this scale already built in through Growing Success, where we have a 4-level, well, I guess essentially 5-level scale, right? We have a level 4, 3, 2, 1, or R for those students who are not meeting at least the minimum criteria to have a passing grade.
Yeah, and I do like that better. But I mean, there's still room for improvement, I think. Because another thing that we tend to do as teachers is we give quizzes as we are teaching, and then we do more activities that we're marking, and then we do a final unit test where we're doing overall learning. And part of me questions, why are we marking all of them? Like, if you're struggling at the beginning with a quiz and your teacher sees that and then addresses it with you and finds a way for you to improve that mark and that learning so that by the end you're demonstrating it much more consistently and effectively, why aren't we taking that most effective mark? Because that's the learning, right?
Right. Yeah. So focusing on the summative tasks over the formative ones, for sure.
And most recent, most consistent, which is in Growing Success as well. Like, we should be doing that. And in my class, that makes sense because it's a language class. And so skills we're building on throughout the semester, and you're going to demonstrate these skills differently throughout the semester. So like, most recent, most consistent makes so much sense for me. It doesn't in a lot of like science is harder because it's content, but I don't know.
Okay, so if we focus then on, well, okay, we're not going to use a 100-point scale. What are we going to use? As we just suggested, using a scale with fewer points is kind of an ideal way to go. So you don't have to use a 5-point scale. You could use a 3-point scale. You could use a 2-point scale. You could use a 1-point scale. So really, it kind of depends on how many sort of transition points you want between different grades and how you want to be able to discern between the different levels. The reason I like these minimum scales quite a bit is because it's a lot easier for you to say, okay, yeah, a student's a level 4 versus a level 3 versus a level 2 or a level 1. Like, there's actually, it's easier to make that judgment.
Yeah, you can see it more clearly at that point.
And that's because we're not then having to decide between that 88 or 87, right? And so it's not as difficult to be able to discern between those different levels.
And I kind of like rubrics, though, that are that 1-point scale. I kind of give them the success criteria as like a checklist. And I think that's like my level 3 is what I've been figuring out. Because if you can do all of this, I know that you have, you've demonstrated that learning, which is like our level 3. But then within there, I can see the differences between the 3 and 4, if that makes sense.
That's interesting, because I've kind of gone the opposite. And I do, again, like that sort of 1-point scale, but I've started creating these mastery criteria and listing out exactly what I would want to see for basically a level 4. So a student achieving 80% or greater on a particular task. And so I will list out everything that would be essentially that top level. And then I set my criteria so that in order for students to get a pass for that particular thing, they have to have checked off at least 80% of the criteria that I've listed. So I guess, I don't know, maybe 80% of the mastery criteria, like, is that a level 4? Is that a level 3? I don't know.
Yeah.
Right?
I don't know. That's the question. But it's been an interesting experience. And I've liked kind of my students' reaction to it and how they like that it's so clearly laid out. Like, this is what we need to do. We've had these conversations and there are no guessing games, which is always nice.
Now, I would say, like, with the way I lay out my mastery criteria, and I do that in my classroom, I do allow my students 3 attempts to demonstrate Yep. mastery on that particular assignment or task for me, because then when I come up with grades, I have a whole system. And if you want to go back and listen and learn a little bit more about my system, we do have that episode on specifications grading. We can link it in the show notes for you if you want to check that out.
I love the 3 attempts. I love that you're giving students a chance to kind of go back and work on it to improve it. And I think that makes such a big difference. I think that's a great idea.
It is. And for the most part, parents love it. It's interesting, though. We just had our parent-teacher interview night, and I did have one parent. And these are high-achieving students, so maybe this is why. But she kind of questioned at first why I had 3 attempts. She's like, I think he should only have 1 attempt. But then I explained my process. I explained, like, how high I keep my expectations for students and how high the bar is set. And that's the reason why I have the 3 attempts. Plus, you know, not everyone can develop mastery of a skill on the first attempt. So once I had gone through that explanation, like, she understood it a lot better. But I thought that was kind of funny.
That is kind of funny. You shouldn't be giving my son or daughter that many attempts. I get that, though. They're probably thinking, like, we're watering it down, and really we're not. We're actually higher the expectations. We're raising those so that it's like, it's no longer a 50 to pass. Like, we're looking to get you up there higher. So, I mean, it's great.
Yeah, everything I have in my classroom, like, to pass is an 80%. So that's why I allow those multiple attempts, because sometimes it takes students that long to get to a level that I would consider mastery.
Yeah. And for me, what I'm doing, it's obviously not the same, but that's because I have a lot of repetition in some of the skills we do. So I give them their checklist. I do mark it so that they can see what they would have gotten. But then the next time we have another assignment with the same writing structures, et cetera, I let them replace that mark. So they can go through it again. We have that conversation. We still do a feedback cycle, and it's the higher mark that they end up getting.
I did play with that a little bit in semester 1 with my classes, and I do like that structure, but I found for mine that they weren't, I don't know, it could have been the way I framed it. Maybe it just doesn't mesh with my teaching style, which is fine, right? Not everything's going to mesh with everybody's styles, but I really struggled to get my students to progress in their skills.
Whereas, like, I think for us, because it is a language class and that's what we're targeting, it's a little different.
I don't know. It could be maybe mindsets of students coming into a science yeah. class versus a language class, right? Like, it yeah. could be just something, I don't know, even as silly as that.
Yeah, it could be. And it's different students, different kind of goals. A lot of them really want to move through the levels quickly. So there is that motivation to kind of step up and get those skills developed more quickly than not.
So I have a few other suggestions that you might consider, especially if using a minimum scale is not quite where you want to go yet, or maybe it's a little bit too much of a change for you in your classroom. So there are some ways that you can still use a 100-point scale, but use them in different ways. So I think the first one we should talk about is setting a minimum grade. So for example, let's take Ontario, a passing grade is 50. So you could set your minimum grade to 40. And so what that means is every entry that you put into your mark book, the lowest one that goes in is a 40. And that, I know, sounds very controversial. You know, a student hasn't done anything, why am I putting a 40 in? But what you're really doing with this system is you're bringing your differences between grades to something that's more equitable. So the difference between a 40 and a 50, right, is 10 points, and then a 50 to 60 to the next letter grade is 10, and so on all the way up the scale. So every sort of gradation is 10 points instead of all the passing ones are only 10 points, and then that failing one is 50.
Yeah, it's essentially like a 6-point scale, 40 through 100.
It is, yeah, or a 60-point scale, I guess, maybe.
Yeah, true.
So if you're U.S.-based, like if you have your minimum passing grade at 60, then you set your minimum grade to 50.
Yeah.
See, I like to suggest that, but that can make a lot of teachers really, really uncomfortable. Like,
I know.
Sit with yourself right now. If you're listening to this right now, how uncomfortable is that making you feel?
Well, I'm not going to lie to you. Sometimes it makes me uncomfortable when I know that I haven't seen a student all semester and I'm putting in 40s. That does make me uncomfortable.
Right.
But I think that's also a bigger conversation. You know what I mean? Like, that's not going to be one that just sits idly and I'm not having conversations with administration and guidance and parents and everyone else.
Yeah. And I think that's why I kind of like the minimum grade scale instead. So if you're going to put something in your mark book that's based on a 4-3-2-1-0 scale, you just put in 4-3-2-1 or 0. And that way you could still have your zeros and it doesn't feel so horrible. But then to go from a 0 to a 1 is only 1 point difference. And something to consider when you're using a scale like that is you need to have a grade conversion scale at the end. Like a 4 is not 100% and a 3 is not 75%. Like you have to know, okay, if I have between, say, a 3.5 and a 4, like what does that mean in terms of a 100-point scale? Eventually, you do need that grade conversion of some sort because eventually, like you said, we do have to put in a grade usually based on a 100-point scale at some point.
Yep. That is the reality.
Yeah.
But we can still modernize it and kind of change our approach to how we get there. And I think that's the big lesson here is we don't have to just do status quo and what has been done in the past. We can find something that works better.
Another one that you might consider is specific grades. So you can still use your 100-point scale, but instead of putting in, say, a random 98 or a 76 or a 63 or whatever, you can decide on, okay, if my student's in this range, I'm going to put a 95 or an 85 or a 75, 65, 55, 45. Like you could pick specific grades and get that, again, that consistent kind of scale going down in terms of how many points are in between each one, but you only pick a certain number.
And that's, I think, similar to the level system and how it's set up in our gradebook system. And it works.
It is, and it works. And I think it can help if you're not quite there yet with thinking about that smaller scale.
Definitely.
And then I would say the other big one is think about your zeros.
I know. And those are hard conversations to have. And I understand it, but I think that they're worth having. It's kind of like when we start to have some difficult conversations about equity and racism and all the rest, and we always say, you need to question your emotional responses and why are you feeling that way? I feel like a zero is the same conversation. Why do we feel that way? Why do we get defensive about it? Why does it make us uncomfortable?
And I just remembered something too, or what you said just kind of sparked something for me in that minimum grade, putting in like a 40 instead of a zero, like if you're putting in a zero, what does that zero actually mean? Does it mean that your student has zero comprehension of the skill or topic? Or does it mean that they have zero compliance?
100% it is zero compliance, typically.
Right?
That is what it is.
So yes, maybe the comprehension is not there, but is it really zero? And I think that's where the argument for putting in a minimum grade comes from, is that, yes, there is some comprehension there, but what you're seeing is a lack of compliance, so you're not getting that information to be able to then put the comprehension into a number.
Yes, but if you've seen them demonstrate that skill in class, is there a way that helps you understand better why it would be a 40 versus a zero. Mm-hmm. So maybe they were non-compliant for that assignment or that test, and many different factors come into play there. But you saw them completing the work and they were able to demonstrate some of that learning. Is that we should still value that?
So that zero, then the non-compliance, like I guess maybe thinking about, well, how can you get any kind of demonstration of knowledge from that student. And some students will take the zero because they just don't know what to do.
Or they're just not motivated by school.
Exactly, right? So what can we then do in terms of consequences instead of putting in a zero?
And I think that, you know, the title of this book is Grading for Equity. And I think it's recognizing that some of these students that are doing this, it's because school is not for them. And they probably come from some pretty tough situations. And it's not that they want to piss you off and give you a zero. Likelihood is it just doesn't work for them. And we need to find a different way to get through to them and help them learn and be successful.
Yeah, I think we definitely need an episode on zeros because we could talk about zeros for a very, very, very long time and different ways that we could go get about, like, what do you do if you don't give zeros? So we'll explore that in a later episode for sure. Mm-hmm.
I like it.
I guess then the last sort of thing for us to chat about is, all right, so we've kind of talked about it a little bit. Is if we use these minimum scales or if we don't use a 100-point scale in our classroom, what do we do when we have to use it? How do we get back to that grade? Because inevitably, that's what's going to happen, at least for us at midterm and final reporting time. We have to enter in a grade that's out of 100.
Yeah, and so I think that's where coming up with those specific numbers or those specific, you know, how it relates to the different levels or whatever system that you have set up. You do need those, unfortunately, or fortunately, I don't know. But we need to make it actually convert onto a 100-point scale because at the end of the day, that is our responsibility. So that's where, like, our grade book program is pretty good that way because we are levels 1 through 4 to Ontario in Ontario, and it allows for a numerical grade or mark based on those different levels so that when I'm inputting it, I do input it by level, but it converts it automatically.
Yeah, so there's definitely that. I also really love using conferencing with my students. So I will have, for example, students will be performing within a specific level, but it might have 10 points in terms of the 100-point scale. So where does the student lie in that specific range? Well, I sit down with them and I conference with them at midterm time. And then have them do a little bit of a different process for final reporting time. But we come up with a grade together.
Nice. Yeah, I like that. And that can take time, but it is worth it because it really does allow you to get to know the students a bit more and make them think about their grades and their role in that grade. And I think that's important.
Yeah, it can take a lot of time, but I have a process where I have students doing this pretty big reflection beforehand. And so we use the data that I've collected and the data and evidence that the students have collected. And we use all of those pieces together to come up with that grade.
Which is amazing.
Yeah.
We should be doing more of that. Mm-hmm. I love that.
And then I think maybe one other suggestion I have is if you're using levels, you don't necessarily need to rely on your grade book to spit out an average. Really, like Katie was saying earlier, we do most recent, most consistent. So you could print out the list of all the levels of all the different assignments over the course of the semester and look for trends.
Yeah. And then, you know, sometimes I do a quiz every once in a while, mostly because the students like them and they ask for them and it drives me crazy. But I often go back and I'll know mark it if I notice they have been steadily improving. And so that I'm like, you don't need that low mark because you've taken that feedback and now you can actually show me you've demonstrated that learning. So why would I keep that? So there are ways that you can look and then make sure it is the most accurate in terms of reflecting what your students have learned and demonstrated.
Well, I think we could talk about this for ages more, but yep. I think what we'll do is we'll wrap up our conversation here because that's a really sort of nice place where we've talked about some different ideas for you to consider. So on that note, we'll wrap up our conversation here for today, and we'll include any of the links or resources we talked about here today in our show notes. You can find our show notes at edugals.com/122. That's edugals.com/122.
And if you like what you heard today, then feel free to share it with a colleague or a friend. And don't forget to subscribe on your favorite podcast app so that you don't miss out on any future content.
And as always, we'd love to hear from you. So do you use the 100-point scale? Do you use something different? We would love, love, love to hear it. You can go on to our Flip, at edugals.com/flipgrid and leave us a video message there. Or you can go onto our website at edugals.com and leave us a written response.
Thanks for listening and see you next week. Thanks for listening to this episode of our EduGals podcast. Show notes for this episode are available at edugals.com. That's edugals.com. We'd also love to hear your feedback, so leave us a message on our website.
And if you enjoyed what you heard, please subscribe and consider leaving a rating or review on your favorite podcast app. Until next time, keep being awesome and try something new.